This recording is part of a series of podcasts in which the novel Dear Yoni is read aloud chapter by chapter by the author Lisa Picard. Please note that Dear Yoni contains sexually explicit language and scenes of a sexual nature. It is not suitable for anyone under the age of 18.
Hello and welcome back. I'm really, really pleased that you've decided to join me again this week for this week's podcast recording of Dear Yoni. Last week, I read the first three entries that Jess made into her pillar book diary. And where we left it off last week was where Jess was deciding to take a trip down memory lane. So today I'm going to be reading that first trip of hers down memory lane, which is in fact chapter 1. I hope you enjoy. Chapter 1, 3 years ago, the journey begins. Jessica, where have you disappeared to? I slowly surfaced from my thoughts as I realized that my husband James was talking to me in an extremely annoyed tone. I hadn't even realized that he had stopped pounding away and that his cock was rapidly shriveling as he glared at me with a hurt expression in his eyes. I'm right here, my love. I lied. I had actually been making my Christmas shopping list in my head as I waited for him to finish up so that I could tick make love to James off of my to-do list for the week. No, you're not. I feel like I'm making love to a corpse, he accused, as he rolled off me and got up off the bed, grabbing his underwear on his way to the bathroom. James, wait! My words drifted away as he slammed the bathroom door shut. I heaved a deep sigh as I put on my own underwear, pulled down my nightdress, and tucked the duvet under my chin, secretly, more than just a little bit relieved that I could now go to sleep. But I knew that we were going to have to do something about this situation, and soon. Our relationship was deteriorating as a result of our lackluster sex life. Or was our sex life deteriorating as a result of our mundane routine relationship? Either way, things were not satisfactory, but I was simply too tired right now to figure it all out. As I drifted off to sleep, I resolved that I would tackle the problem the following day. James and I had met at a party, hosted by a mutual friend, during the final months of my 3-year college degree, majoring in English literature and women's studies. Yes, I know, not exactly a combination guaranteed to provide a sustainable income stream upon graduation. A fact that was rapidly becoming abundantly clear to me as I started looking for potential job opportunities. I desperately needed a steady income stream to help me to begin to whittle away at the massive study debt that I would be facing in a few short months' time. I had begun to inwardly curse the school guidance counselor who had assured me that I should simply follow my passion and that everything would fall into place thereafter. Huh. In addition to this ever-present worry, I had recently ended an 18-month relationship with what I now recognize was a malignant narcissist. But at the time, I simply hadn't possessed the emotional maturity, wisdom, or life's experience to recognize the signs. And so my self-confidence was at an all-time low. I had actually decided not to attend the party, but had eventually caved to pressure exerted by my extremely persuasive, extroverted roommate, Alice. However, all too soon I found myself observing, with familiar envy, Alice, the social butterfly, flitting from one sparkling social interaction to the next, whilst I propped up the wall behind the refreshment station, the latter consisting of a metal bath filled with water, melting ice, and an ever-dwindling supply of beers, a small trestle table with several boxes of mediocre wine, and half-empty bottles of cheap spirits languishing in puddles of sticky liqueur. I glanced around the room as I tactically considered how best I might slip away unnoticed. "You look about as uncomfortable as I feel," a voice shouted in my ear, striving to be heard above the thumping bass beat. Whipping around, I discovered a very buttoned-up and preppy-looking young man standing next to me, observing with obvious dismay the beer-chugging and head-banging antics of our fellow partygoers. I very nearly dismissed him with a vague smile in favor of putting my party-leaving strategy into action. But something about the way his too long dark hair curled over his collar and around his ears, and the way he was owlishly blinking at the party scene through his overly large black-rimmed glasses made me feel a sense of solidarity with a fellow introvert. Much like myself, he was clearly completely out of his depth in this awkward social situation. Well, the party certainly picked up after that, for both of us, as we spent the rest of the evening chatting outside, in the relative quiet under the trees. I discovered that James's rather conservative exterior was hiding a wicked sense of humour and a keen intellect. We bonded over books and feminism. James's two moms had ensured that he was well versed in the finer points of women's issues, both personal and political. We discovered that we were both only children, although our backgrounds could not have been more different. James was the highly planned, eagerly anticipated, and much celebrated offspring of a human rights lawyer and a child psychologist. The masculine third party in this equation was the anonymous sperm donor, who had been carefully selected according to an exhaustive list of desirable attributes. In fact, every single aspect of James's conception, birth, and rearing had been similarly subject to much debate and careful attention to detail. After being breastfed for over a year, James had been weaned on homegrown, organic food prepared from scratch. He had only ever worn ethically sourced, natural fabrics his entire life. He had attended the most progressive and expensive schools and had been carefully and consciously exposed to a wide variety of liberal ideas from a very young age. This had been hothouse parenting at its most extreme. And certainly, the process seemed to have produced a well-balanced, polite, intelligent, and conscious young man. Although an introvert by nature, he was quietly and enviably confident of his own inherent worth and lovability. My own upbringing could not have been more different. I was the direct result of my mother's teenaged rebellion against her strictly conservative Catholic parents. 6 months later, when she was no longer able to hide the pregnancy, a no-holds-barred argument with her parents resulted in her running away from home. At midnight, she climbed down the trellis outside her first-floor bedroom and hitched a ride out of town to pursue the father of her unborn child. He was the bass player in a small-time rock band that had been traveling through the one-horse town in which she lived. That's the sum total of the information that I ever received about my biological father, despite having begged my mother and grandparents several times over the years for further details. I was also never told what happened during the following few months. I don't know if my grandparents tried to find my mother or if she contacted them at all. But I do know that my mother appeared at the front door of my grandparents' home in the dead of night and in the advanced stages of labor 3 months later. I was born a few hours later in the maternity ward of the local hospital. Apparently, my mother stayed with her parents for 2 months to breastfeed me and to recover from the birth before leaving again, this time for 3 years. She returned without warning and late at night with a musician in tow, albeit not the one who had sired me. She had come to fetch me to live with her and her lover in a teepee on a communal piece of land a few hours' drive away. Needless to say, a toddler in a teepee in the dead of winter, without running water or ablution facilities, didn't quite work out as she had hoped and planned. And so I was delivered back to my grandparents' home a scant few weeks later. And this was to become the pattern of my childhood. Every few years my mother would turn up, sometimes alone, sometimes with a man, but a different one each time. Then I would be forced to go and live with her for a few months before being unceremoniously dumped back with my grandparents again when she tired of my company. I say forced because somehow I never did form a relationship with my mother. She was simply a stranger who appeared, without warning, to disrupt my life from time to time. My mother seemed to have a penchant for autistic freethinkers who never amounted to much. Perhaps she was deliberately choosing partners who were the very antithesis of her strict and straight-laced parents. But once she had settled with a man, she allowed her entire life to be consumed with taking care of his needs and his desires. So it seemed, to me at least, that she had escaped the strictures of her childhood, only to willingly walk into an assortment of voluntary prisons over the years. I could never understand why my mother wanted me to live with her, as she certainly didn't seem to much enjoy having me around. Mostly she either ignored me or related to me with a vaguely impersonal, off-handed kind of affection. Perhaps, on some level, she believed that she was providing me with a home and a family of sorts. Perhaps she wanted to save me from enduring the strict upbringing that she had found so intolerable. I never did fathom her motivations. The final time I stayed with my mother was when I was 12. I had spent 6 months babysitting the two small children of her latest amour in a tiny drafty apartment. They had lost their mother to cancer a few months earlier, and I did feel compassion and a growing love for the two lost little girls. They weren't much trouble at all, and I could still spend several hours a day on my favorite pastime of reading. My mother and her lover came and went as they pleased, often disappearing for days on end. I actually preferred them gone, because when they were at home, my mother's boyfriend made me feel extremely uncomfortable with these creepy comments, accompanied by drunken leering about how I was growing up so nicely. Ugh. One afternoon, while my mother was in the shower, he put his arm around my shoulder and allowed his fingers to graze the side of my blossoming breast. I threw off his arm and stormed out of the house to the next door neighbor to call my grandparents to come and fetch me. I stayed seated at the neighbor's kitchen table, drinking tea and sullenly avoiding her anxious inquiries until my grandparents arrived. Thereafter, I sat in their car while an almighty row blazed inside the apartment. When my mother appeared at the car window with a tear-stained face to say goodbye before we left, I yelled at her that I hated her and that I would never, ever, ever go with her again. Then I turned my back on her and refused to say another word. When she turned up again, 4 years later, alone and looking haggard and much older than her 34 years, I once again refused to speak to her. I had not seen nor heard from her since. My grandparents provided me with a stable, albeit strict, upbringing. My grandmother was a cold and stern but scrupulously fair woman. My grandfather left the raising of me entirely to his wife. He spent his days in the garden, sometimes gardening, but mostly just sitting in the shed, endlessly whittling away pieces of wood. I think this was his escape from the silent, cold resentment that pervaded the house. As long as I got good grades, attended church on Sunday morning, and was quiet and respectful, I was left to my own devices. This suited me very well, as it meant that I had plenty of time to lose myself in my reading. From an early age, my refuge had always been books. I suppose it was my version of my grandfather's whittling, an escape from the harsh reality of my home life, but also an escape from the awkward teenage social interactions that I always seemed to fail at so dismally. When I was 16, I discovered the writings of the American feminist Gloria Steinem, and a light went on inside of me. I decided that I too was a feminist and that I would remain in charge of my own life. I was determined that I would never allow any man to disrupt my life in the way that my mother had. Of course, all of my feminist ideals flew out of the window when I fell in love with a teaching assistant in my second year at university. It seems as if the sins of the mothers really are visited upon the daughters, as I soon realized just how much emotional and psychological abuse I too was prepared to put up with, in the name of love. But perhaps the years of feminist teachings did amount to something after all, as I was finally able to break free from my codependency with my narcissistic boyfriend after 18 months. However, the experience definitely didn't leave me unscathed, and my self-esteem was shot to pieces when I met James at that party. So it was such a relief to spend time with someone who actually listened to and valued my point of view. Someone who didn't criticize me, but rather seemed to find me interesting and attractive even. Someone who could hold a conversation instead of just grandstanding. Someone who didn't diminish or gaslight me all the time. It felt like balm to my wounded soul. By the time we both graduated a few months later, James and I were officially an item. I finally caught a break and found a job as an editorial assistant at a small LGBTQI publishing company, thanks to one of James's mums, who called in a favor with an old college friend of hers, working in publishing. However, my fond fantasies of spending my days reading great feminist literature with a red correcting pen in hand were rapidly crushed. My job entailed making coffee, filing, general admin, and countless hours spent chipping away at the ever-growing slush pile of unsolicited manuscripts in search of a hidden gem that could potentially become the next bestseller. Obviously, my pay grade reflected my level of responsibility. Had James and I not moved in together, I might have found myself forced to move back home with my grandparents whilst I paid off my massive study debt. I was immensely grateful that this was not necessary, even though I had to deal with my grandparents' disappointment and displeasure at my sinful behavior. My choice to live with James without the legitimization of a marriage ring seemed to indicate to my grandmother that, despite her very best efforts at raising me correctly, I had turned out to be just like my mother, after all. James suffered through a succession of poorly paid internships whilst he was finishing off his CA. But when he finally passed all of his examinations a few years later, he found a job as a junior financial manager at a medium-sized corporate. As James began to enjoy some career success, he slowly crept out of his introverted shell and gained more social confidence, which led to us gradually beginning to develop a small group of close friends. However, he still preferred quiet evenings in front of the TV to social interactions, which suited me just fine, as I could spend my time enjoying my reading. Although we definitely weren't living the high life, our life together was quietly satisfying to both of us. James's career success meant that we were finally able to move out of our tiny rented bachelor's apartment into a small duplex. I had by this time started working as a freelance copy editor, which paid far better than the publishing house had ever paid, and also gave me more freedom with respect to my working hours. When I was 25 and James was 28, we finally tied the knot, which did somewhat mend my relationship with my grandmother. But we both agreed that we would wait a few years for James to get ahead in his career and for us to purchase our first home before having children. And 7 years later, somehow, we had still not gotten round to having children, even though now we owned our modest home in the suburbs outright, the mortgage having been paid off thanks to an inheritance from a wealthy aunt of James's. James was now on an accelerated career path as assistant to the financial director at his company, and was being groomed for the position of financial director when the present incumbent retired in a year's time. My own freelance work provided a steady source of income, and so we had more than enough resources to start a family. Yet somehow, we just weren't making this a priority. And any discussions that either of us initiated on this topic rapidly shifted to other, less contentious topics. At this point, after almost 7 years of marriage, the magic in our relationship was definitely in the final stages of rigor mortis. Our sex life was yet another victim of our busy schedules, and although I prided myself on making sure that we had sex once a week, it was, more often than not, just a perfunctory nod to the exciting romance we both knew we wanted, yet somehow didn't end up prioritizing. As sex increasingly became more of a chore than a joy, I found myself wondering, surely there had to be more to sex than this meaningless mutual scratching of an itch? This momentary, short-lived release? But if I had to be brutally honest with myself, I had always wondered that, even during the early part of my relationship with James, and certainly with all of my lovers prior to James. The frantic coupling, the strange loneliness and isolation, even during this most intimate of acts, the fantasies playing out in my mind, followed by a brief release of energy and an orgasm, if I was lucky, that is. It was mildly depressing, and certainly didn't bear any resemblance whatsoever to the epic sex portrayed in romance movies or discussed at great length in Cosmopolitan magazine. Was it me? Was I doing something wrong? Or perhaps I just didn't have the necessary sex drive, or just wasn't exciting enough. I had always wondered whether my male lovers felt the same, but there was no way of asking them without insinuating that they hadn't satisfied me. Heaven forbid. The male ego can be so terribly fragile, you know. And so I just never asked whether they were satisfied, and they never volunteered the information. I just assumed that the problem was mine alone. And I ended up putting it inside a box in my mind and burying it deep in the back of the closet, labeled "Things to Address at Some Point." James and I were able to avoid talking about the problem throughout the holiday season. What with all the parties and cooking and eating and presents and family and friends, we never seemed to have a moment alone together. And we fell into bed exhausted from too much food and drink most nights. And he seemed to be spending more and more time alone in his home office, which actually suited me fine, as I just didn't have the extra energy available to deal with the issue. But by the 3rd of January, all the parties were finally over. And as I sat in my big overstuffed armchair, making my New Year's resolutions, I knew that the time had finally come to address the problem. And so, resolution number 3, following after number 1, go to gym at least 3 times per week, and number 2, get that loose dental crown replaced, was number 3, sex. That was it. I didn't know what I wanted to do about it, just that something, anything, needed to be done. But after a couple of hours in the armchair, spent brainstorming the problem, and yes, I admit, I did ask Mr. Google for some advice, I'd come up with the beginnings of a plan. Perhaps there was a way in which I could begin to address my long-standing yearning to experience more during sex, whilst, at the same time, reinvigorating my sex life and my relationship with my husband. That night, after a modest supper of chicken salad, resolution number 4, eat healthier, James and I were sitting in the lounge, watching a mediocre movie on Netflix. I had been watching James, watching the movie, for a while. I noticed that he really needed a haircut. His dark hair was curling around his ears and... Wait! Was that? Oh my God! James had long hairs beginning to creep out of his ears. We were officially getting old. And we seemed to spend all of our time together in front of the TV, just like a pair of boring middle-aged suburbanites. James was still a very attractive man, though. I just couldn't understand why sex with him was such a chore. This had to change. And it was changing right now, I resolved to myself. The time had finally arrived to make some effort with resolution number 3. James, I began, can I talk to you about something? What's that? He asked, not taking his eyes from the television screen. James, please. I disliked the whiny tone in my voice. And so I cleared my throat and tried again. James, I want to talk to you about our sex life. I sounded much more in charge now and was rewarded by James looking up at me and turning off the TV. Well, now that's a surprise. I could see that I had his full attention now. Honey, we've not really been connecting sexually for a while now. I know that we've both got a lot on our plates, but it feels like we're losing us. And I want to do something about that. Oh, babe, I'm so relieved that you feel the same way I do. I've been wanting to talk to you about this for a long time, but I didn't want to make you feel like there was anything wrong with you. It's both of us. Somehow we've lost the magic somewhere along the way. I miss us too, he said, with a wistful smile, as he pulled me towards himself and gave me a gentle, one-armed, sideways hug. This was definitely progress, as we hadn't touched at all for over 2 weeks. I've made a New Year's resolution to find a way to reignite our sex life, I informed James, and he lifted his right eyebrow in that sexy way I loved so much and gave me an exaggerated saucy wink. I felt a distinct surge of attraction. Perhaps this wasn't such a big problem after all. My husband really was extremely hot. Really? He drawled. That sounds so great. What were you thinking of doing? Well, I'm not going to tell you right now. It's a surprise. But let's just say that it involves some shopping. I grinned, attempting to flutter my eyelashes at my husband, but probably ending up looking as if I had something stuck in my eye. Oh no, he groaned. I might have guessed that spending money would be involved. But he had a twinkle in his eye as he pulled me closer for a proper hug. I sighed as I relaxed in my husband's arms. I really shouldn't have worried. everything was going to work out just fine. Day 4. Dear Yoni, well, the months that followed were certainly loads of fun. And James and I definitely did spend a lot more time thinking and talking about sex, and actually having sex too. I spent a small fortune on lacy lingerie. The crotchless panties were a huge hit. And various dildos, vibrators, cock rings, sex board games, and many other toys. I even bought a lockbox with a secure padlock to house all of our new sexy paraphernalia and to protect it from the prying eyes of our domestic helper. And certainly, for a while, the sight of that sturdy black plastic box emerging from beneath our bed was sufficient to get us into the mood. But after about 3 months or so, as work challenges began to take their toll again, I noticed that the lockbox was spending most of its time hidden under the bed. Neither of us seemed willing or able to generate the necessary enthusiasm or energy to play with the toys anymore, and gradually our sex life returned to its previous lackluster condition. With the added burden of guilt at spending so much money on toys and lingerie that we no longer used. And in my more honest moments of introspection, I had to admit to myself that all of the toys and other paraphernalia had been a big disappointment for me. None of them had even begun to address my vague yearning for sex to be so much more than it always ended up being. We returned to our habit of TV watching and reading every single night, but then some new inspiration arrived. And that's it for today, dear listener. Join me again next week for the next podcast recording of Dear Yoni. Bye.